Just a reminder, the programme is available to listen to again on the Radio 3 website. You can also download it as a podcast at bbc.co.uk/podcasts. And you can watch the webcast of the Winners' Gala concert later today in St Petersburg online. They'll also be performing at the Barbican in September with Valeri Gergiev and the LSO. For full details, just go to the Music Matters page of the Radio 3 website. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio, and you can also listen to us live online. Just gone 1 o'clock. Time for the news, read by David Cornett.
A hospital doctor facing criminal charges in the Gulf state of Bahrain has told the BBC he was beaten into making a confession on television. The doctor said he'd been forced to say that he had harmed rather than treated anti-government protesters. The authorities in Bahrain have formally opened talks with the opposition after months of unrest. President Assad of Syria has dismissed the provincial governor of Hama, where a huge demonstration took place yesterday. Tens of thousands of protesters are reported to have marched through Hama with little resistance from security forces. The province is one of the main centres of the Syrian uprising, which is now in its fourth month. The American Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has rejected threats made by the Libyan leader, Colonel Gaddafi, that he is prepared to carry out attacks in Europe. Colonel Gaddafi said that unless NATO stopped its airstrikes, Libyans would, as he put it, move into Europe like locusts to attack homes and offices. The government is trying to encourage teachers to take children on more school trips. It says it wants schools to scrap unnecessary paperwork and put aside misplaced concerns about health and safety. Campaigners for disabled people are starting legal action against the government over proposed cuts to disability living allowance. Ministers want to spend £2 billion less on the allowance each year, but charities say the negative impact hasn't been properly assessed. The Department for Work and Pensions says it's working with disability organisations. A woman who contracted food poisoning during a recent outbreak of E. coli in France has died. The 78-year-old woman was taken to hospital in Bordeaux just over a week ago. The source of the outbreak is being investigated. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge will continue their tour of Canada today with a trip to Montreal. They'll visit a hospital specialising in children's care and they'll join a cookery class. And the weather, cloud developing this afternoon and perhaps an isolated shower, but feeling warm in light winds. It'll stay dry in most places tonight and tomorrow. BBC News and Weather at 1:03.
And it was read by David Cornett. It's time now on Radio 3 to join Catherine Bott for the first of this weekend's early music shows, which are both dedicated to travel.
Lauda Jerusalem Domino.
Thank you. What grand and imposing music that is, antiphonal style, with groups of singers and instrumentalists playing together and sometimes definitely against each other, but all united by the magnificent sound of the organ. It's music by Adrian Willaert, the first composer to make this effect famous. And before we go on, here are the performers. Wonderful names coming up. Collegio Vocale e Strumentale e Euterpe. The organist is Riccardo Villani, and the director of the whole glorious ensemble is Antonio Eros Negri. That was Willaert's Lauda Jerusalem. And the exciting antiphonal techniques that he is said to have pioneered came from his tenure of the Chapel of St. Mark's in Venice. He was maestro di cappella there for 35 years before his death in 1562. And he was known as the new Pythagoras because he was a great, great teacher. Almost everybody who was anybody wanted to study with Willaert in Venice. Back in 17th century England, 50 years after Willaert had died, there was a tremendous amount of interest in the spectacle and the general musical style of the Venetian school because of one man. He's the subject of today's early music show, and before I name him, I'll try to sum him up. Well, he wasn't a composer. He wasn't even a musician. He was a sort of court jester, an intrepid adventurer, a pioneering travel writer, and a good all-round old-fashioned English eccentric. His name was Thomas Coriat. And in just a few moments, I'm going to be talking about him with my guest today, Tony Wheeler, who's the co-founder of Lonely Planet. But before we delve into Coriat's fascinating world and the extraordinary travels and the even more extraordinary and excitable way in which he wrote about them, let's hear some more of that ravishing music from the Venetian school. This is a work that was performed at some Venetian festivities, witnessed by and written about by Thomas Coriat, Giovanni Gabrieli's Buccinate in Neomenia Tuba.
Thank you.
Buccinate in Neomenia Tuba, a 19-part piece by Giovanni Gabrieli, performed by the Gabrieli Consort and Players, directed by Paul McCreesh. Well, now it's time to welcome my guest. We're going to find out together more about Thomas Coriat, the man who wrote so engagingly about Venetian music for an early 17th century English public. Welcome, Tony Wheeler, co-founder of Lonely Planet. Tony, how did you get interested in this extraordinary man, Thomas Coriat?
I was in India in 1980 when we were doing the very first Lonely Planet guide to India. And I went to the town of Surat, and in this ancient guidebook I had, it just mentioned that he'd walked all the way from England to India in the 1600s, spending, I think it was a penny a day or something. And then he died in Surat. And that was the first time I'd ever heard his name mentioned. And it intrigued me immediately. And in subsequent years, his path and my path have seemed to cross on a number of occasions.
So did you have the same sort of start that he did? What was his start in life?
Well, he was an early backpacker, I suppose you could say. He grew up in Somerset. His father was a rector of a church in Odcombe in Somerset. He went off to Oxford University and didn't actually graduate, but was obviously an intelligent person. He was very good at languages. Everyone said that of him. And then he became a part of Prince Henry's court. I think it was rather like the sort of court jester, the person who could be depended upon to tell after-dinner jokes and know a little bit about everything. But without any real job, he was just, you know, whatever money fell his way. He was someone who lived on his wits.
But the young Thomas Coriat must have been rather intrigued by all the foreign music which was being welcomed into the English courts by Prince Henry, like this piece, written in England by Thomas Lupo, one of the immigrant Italian players at court. Thomas Lupo's Ardo Si, played by the viol consort Fretwork. My guest today, talking about Thomas Coriat, is Tony Wheeler of Lonely Planet. Tony, why did Coriat decide to go off on his first journey? I mean, was it like a gap year?
I think really it was. I think one of the things that people have said about him was when he did this first great trip of his, which was in 1608, he spent his gap year summer sort of thing, walking around Europe. He walked all the way to Venice and back, about 1,500 miles in 5 months. So quite a lot of walking. And it was well before the whole idea of the Grand Tour developed. He was a pioneer in that respect. So no one had really thought of that. And when he came back, he wrote a book about it. And No one really knew what this book was about. I mean, travel in those days, you went because you were going to conquer something, or it was a religious pilgrimage, or it was business. And he wasn't doing any of those things. He was just traveling around because he wanted to see things with his own eyes. I mean, he was a pioneering tourist.
And he didn't have Lonely Planet to guide him on his way.
No, he didn't have. In fact, you know, a lot of the information he brought back, he copied things down. He made assiduous notes. He could have been a guidebook writer very easily. And he came back and recorded these things. And a lot of the information that he recorded, you know, the inscriptions have been lost. The only early reports come from his pen. So that first book that he wrote, you know, it was a pioneering piece of work.
What about how he travelled? You've said this is years before the Grand Tour, and I can't help it. I always have this vague idea in my mind of the 18th century Grand Tour, of being done in a coach and four, and the young master going round to explore the courtesans of Europe and a few art treasures, a bit like some modern gap years, I suppose. And this was not possible in 1608, was it?
Well, it certainly wasn't possible on his amount of money. You know, he didn't have the ATM card from Dad and the ability to pull money out in different places. He was doing it on the cheap. He was a definite early backpacker in that respect. And really, he walked. And he was very proud of how far he'd walked. I mean, he came back and, you know, he donated the shoes to his father's church. And for 100 years, they hung in the church. And they had a church cleanup at some point, and the shoes disappeared. But if you go to that church today, there's a stone replica of his original shoes on the wall of the church.
Looking nice and worn, I would imagine. You've seen them.
I've seen them, yeah. My little sort of pilgrimage following Mr. Coryat has taken me to the place where he started in Somerset and the place where he died in Surat.
Well, before he ever got as far as Surat, he went to France. Coryat describes the journey and his seasickness, and from this passage you will get a very good picture of his literary style. I had varnished the exterior parts of the ship with the excremental ebullitions of my tumultuous stomach, as desiring to satiate the gormandizing paunches of the hungry haddocks, according as I have hieroglyphically expressed it in the front of my book. With that I had superfluously stuffed myself at land, having made my rumbling belly their capacious aumbry. And an aumbry is a store cupboard. So he ate too much and said goodbye to it all on board ship. Oh, dear. Coryat's book is a travelogue, but unlike quite a lot of guidebooks or travelogues of these days, he inserts anecdotes to demonstrate things at various points. And here's another very good one. He's writing about a story of the wars. He's in Amiens. And the high point of the tale is about the Spanish commander besieging the city in 1597, disguised 40 or 50 soldiers as peasants, with fardels upon their heads and shoulders and pistols and daggers under their coats. Early one morning, they followed a farm cart going through the city gate, and here we go on with Coryat's own words. As soon as ever the cart was gotten under the portcullis, one of the peasants untied closely a sack of walnuts which he carried, and let them all fall out. And while the corps de garde, which kept the gate, were scrambling to gather them up, another of these disguised soldiers cuts the harness of the horse, and so with cart and horse barricadoed and stopped the passage of the gate. And then the rest drew forth their weapons, seized upon the rest that guarded the gate, and made themselves the masters of it. How easy it all was in those days.
Sing me in the voice.
Oliver Schnebeli directing the players and singers of the Centre for Baroque Music in Versailles in a Te Deum, We Praise You, O God, by Lejeune. You're listening to the Early Music Show, apparently on our travels with early 17th century travel writer and pioneer Thomas Coriat, but actually here in Broadcasting House, and with me is my guest Tony Wheeler of Lonely Planet, who's followed Coriat's travels and knows a great deal about him. Tony, was he much of a writer before his travels? I mean, obviously he had to write essays at Oxford, presumably, but...
I don't think so. I think, you know, he was certainly very verbose. He certainly liked to write at great length. And his writing, you know, a lot of it is still very alive today. He didn't mince his words.
And he's credited with introducing both the fork and the umbrella to England.
Exactly.
Is that really true?
It certainly seems to be that we had spoons and we had knives, but we hadn't yet discovered the fork at that time. The fork was a European or an Italian invention, he claims, and he was quite impressed by this. He liked the way the Italians used this fork. They didn't have to pick food up with their fingers. They could stab things with their fork. And he got himself a fork, and he used it when he was in Italy and then in other countries on his way back to England, and, you know, showed off with it when he was back in England. And eventually, you know, in the years to come, people started using forks as well. And Coriat does have his name down as the person who brought the fork to our country.
Well, let's get on to his eventual turning up in Venice. I've read what he has to say about Venice. And he goes there from Padua, which is now a really very brief journey. I did it myself last year. And he says, when he first sees Venice, I saw Venice, which yieldeth the most glorious and heavenly show upon the water that ever any mortal eye beheld, such a show as did even ravish me both with delight and admiration. And of course, nowadays, if you've got the money to arrive in Venice by water taxi, it's exactly the same, isn't it?
You know, I love Venice, and I think he hits it on the head there. And it's a place that, you know, OK, there's these huge crowds in St. Mark's Square, but there's so much more of Venice. And you only have to go a little bit away from the square and you find yourself in churches where you're all by yourself. And it's still a wonderful place. And I like the fact that he was so enthusiastic about it then. And of course, he also, music was one of the things that he spent some time recording then. And his written records of that early music are some of the best that we have today.
So finally, Thomas Coriat has reached Venice, where he stayed for a while and took notes on every aspect of the city, from what they wore to what they ate to what they did in church. And here he also included some wonderful rhapsodical descriptions of the festivities that took place.
Oh,
This feast consisted principally of music, which was both vocal and instrumental. So good, so delectable, so rare, so admirable, so super excellent, that it did even ravish and stupefy all those strangers that never heard the like. But how others were affected with it, I know not. For mine own part, I can say this, that I was for the time even wrapped up with St. Paul into the third heaven. Sometimes there sung 16 or 20 men together, having their master or moderator to keep them in order, and when they sung, the instrumental musicians played also. Sometimes 16 played together upon their instruments, 10 sagbuts, 4 cornets, and 2 viol de gambas of an extraordinary greatness. Sometimes 10, 6 sagbuts and 4 beautiful cornets. Sometimes 2, a cornet and a treble viol. That night's music continued 3 whole hours at the least, for they began about 5 of the clock and ended not before 8. Also, it continued as long in the morning. At every time that every several music played, the organs, whereof there are 7 fair pair in that room, standing all in a row together, played with them. Of the singers, there were 3 or 4 so excellent that I think few or none in Christendom do excel them, especially one who had such a peerless and, as I may in a manner say, such a supernatural voice, for such a privilege, for the sweetness of his voice, as sweetness that I think there was never a better singer in all the world. I always thought that he was an eunuch, which if he had been, it had taken away some part of my admiration, because they do most commonly sing passing well. But he was not. Therefore, it was much the more admirable. Again, it was the more worthy of admiration, because he was a middle-aged man, as about 40 years old. For nature doth more commonly bestow such a singularity of voice upon boys and striplings than upon men of such years. Besides, it was far the more excellent, because it was nothing forced, strained, or affected, but came from him with the greatest facility that ever I heard. Truly, I think that had a nightingale been in the same room and contended with him for the superiority, something perhaps he might excel him, because God hath granted that little bird such a privilege for the sweetness of his voice as to none other. But I think he could not much. To conclude, I attribute so much to this rare fellow for his singing that I think the country where he was born may be as proud for breeding so singular a person as Smyrna was of her Homer, Verona of her Catullus, or Mantua of Virgil. But exceeding happy may that city or town or person be that possesseth this miracle of nature. Paul McCreesh directing the Gabrielli Consort and players in Audi Dulcis Amica Mea by Barbarino, and it was preceded not only by the Gabriellis performing a Gabrielli Magnificat, but in between those two pieces I read from Thomas Coriat's absolutely carried away passage about the description of the music for the Festival of Saint Roch. Coriat soaked up everything about Venice like a sponge, and it was mercifully free of that slight sentimentality that we have to imbue Venice with now, because, of course, it's sinking and we must worry about it. And he wasn't worried about it because it wasn't sinking. Great big cruise liners weren't coming in to ruin the ecology of the marine basin. And he just goes on about how people kiss when they meet. Men kiss. I'm getting what you've said about him already, that he's a bit English.
Oh, he was a bit English. I know later on in one of his books he comments on a place where women rode horses not side saddle, and he was quite shocked about this. This was something he'd never seen before and hoped he'd never have to see again. It was a real surprise to him.
And I'm wondering how people in England reacted. Is it known to his passages about his discovery of the two kinds of people that were new to him in Venice, the courtesan and the mountebank?
Well, he did outrage people, yeah. But, I mean, this is what they found delightful about his book and his writing, that he was politically incorrect. But he came back from his Europe trip and wrote a book about it, and the book was a great success. But I think all the time he was sort of looking for respect, which he felt he didn't get.
Well, I do actually think, I mean, I haven't read it all by any means, but I've read a fair amount of the original Coriat's crudities, and it's actually very readable for a book published so long ago.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it is because of that enthusiasm he brings to it. And, you know, the crudities, it's the French word for raw vegetables. And his idea is that these are his raw impressions, that they haven't been carefully prepared. They've just been, this is what I saw, this is what I did, and I've seen it and I'll put it straight out there. And it was a pioneering work.
Yeah, we shouldn't misconstrue Coriat's crudities. Could sound like crude, a sort of musical turn, but no, he means it in the sense of raw impressions, crudité. Yeah. Let's hear some more of that Venetian music written about so engagingly by Thomas Coriat. The Gabrieli Consort and Players, directed by Paul McCreesh, in the Sonata No. 18 in 14 parts by Giovanni Gabrieli. Sir Thomas Coriat came home from his first journey to Venice, wrote it all up, made some money from the book. Did he ever settle down?
No, well, you see, he came back and his job as the court jester had sort of moved on, and he did make some money from his book, but not as much as he'd hoped to do. And he then conceived the idea of doing a much bigger, much more impressive trip. It was almost as if, well, if walking all the way to Venice and back didn't impress you, look at what I'll do next.
And he went in 1612. He went to Asia.
Yeah,
well, but of course he never survived to write about it.
No, and also the other really sad thing is that we know he did write, but his notes were all lost. He left a large amount of notes behind in Isfahan, a beautiful town in the south of Iran. And he had more notes with him when he got to India. And really, all these notes are lost. That all we know about his Asian travels were some notes that he sent back from India and a lot of people he encountered. One of the wonderful encounters was as he was walking through Afghanistan, he met this gentleman, I think it's Sir Robert Shirley, I think his name was, who was bringing elephants back from India.
As you do.
As a gift to Shah Abbas in Isfahan to sort of impress him, you know, with how sort of power the British had. You know, we could bring some elephants over as a gift. And Thomas Coriat bumps into him coming the other way and introduces himself. And Robert Shirley says, "Oh, Thomas Coriat, I've got a copy of your book. You know, what do you say? Would you mind autographing it?" You know, this weird encounter in the middle of nowhere, and the person coming the other way with a couple of elephants in tow has your book in his saddlebags. You know, that's just terrific. That's just wonderful.
You couldn't make it up.
No, you could not.
Well, although a lot of Coriat's writings have vanished, sadly, the ones we've got are really valuable. Italian customs and manners described as never before, with a real relish and sometimes incredulity. His accounts of musical events are really, really useful, as well as exciting to read. They were very influential in England at a time when other aspects of Italian culture, the madrigal, for example, had already been in vogue for more than 20 years. And that was all down to a certain Alfonso Ferrabosco, made the reverse trip to that of Coriat. He came from Bologna to London to serve in the court of Elizabeth I. And he inspired in turn a new generation of English composers with their own madrigals and songs, like Giovanni Cooperario, originally John Cooper. He took an Italianised name, and his ode to the most high and mighty Prince Charles could almost have been named after Coriat's quests, with its title Fortune and Glory. Well, I'm not sure whether poor Coriat ever enjoyed quite enough of either of those two things, but it's been wonderful to have my guest in the studio today, Tony Wheeler, to talk about it with me. And I think we should say a big thank you to Thomas Coriat for making the journey in the first place. Let's end with Cooperario. Fortune and Glory, performed by Mark Padmore with fretwork.
Fortune and glory may be lost and won, but when the work of nature is undone, that loss flies past returning, nor help is left but mourning. What can to kind youth more despiteful prove than to be robbed of one sole brother? Father and mother,
Fortune and Glory by Copperario was sung in that recording by Mark Padmore with fretwork. And that ends today's Early Music Show. It was presented by Catherine Bott in conversation with Tony Wheeler, co-founder of Lonely Planet. The producer was Sam Phillips. And Catherine will be back tomorrow for another travel-related Early Music Show at the same time tomorrow. That's just after the 1 o'clock news. And on Wednesday...
An evening of Bach from Tewkesbury Abbey in Gloucestershire. Radio 3 Live in Concert goes to the Cheltenham Festival as the Magdalena Consort explores Bach's musical fascination with numbers. Three cantatas, a motet, and the Brandenburg Concerto, which numerically meant most to him. Radio 3 Live in Concert, Wednesday night at 7:30.
Back to this Saturday afternoon, just gone 2 o'clock, and now a second chance to hear last Monday's lunchtime concert from Wigmore Hall in London. It's introduced by Sean Rafferty.
Welcome to Wigmore Hall, where we welcome today one of the truly great pianists of our time. I know that's a phrase often used, misused sometimes, but not in this case. Elizabeth Leonskaya has eschewed publicity and the trappings of fame to concentrate on her art, and a powerful and shining one it is. A child prodigy in her time, first concert at 11, and while still at the Moscow Conservatory, winning the Ionescu, the Marguerite Long, and the exceptionally demanding Queen Elizabeth International Piano Competitions. Her extraordinary talent was spotted by the great Sviatoslav Richter, and she became not only his protege and pupil, but played duets with the great man. She has quietly and magnificently conquered audiences in the West, too, ever since her sensational debut at Salzburg in 1979. Her pedigree, well, one of her teachers, Jacob Milstein, traces his connections back to Liszt. The last of the Soviet school, she's been called. Well, the important thing is, she says, about the Russian school of piano playing, never really a single school. What is good is the focus on personality. What you are doing is who you are. There was nothing dogmatic, never. Austria is now her adopted home, where 5 years ago she was awarded the Cross of Honour, the highest award of its kind in the country. She has chosen a kindred spirit and fellow countrymen, really, for her recital today. The music is all by Franz Schubert, who happily is also our Composer of the Week here on Radio 3. Elizabeth Leonskaya begins with a short allegretto, an exquisite little piece Schubert wrote as an album leave for his friend Ferdinand Walcher, who was off to Venice with the Austrian Navy. I hope it was played in a lull between clinking glasses at his farewell party, which we know took place in Tax's alehouse. The piano sonata in A, which 664, follows without a break. A youthful work, but certainly far from immature. You get gentleness and grandeur as well. Probably written on holiday in Upper Austria in the same year as the famous Trout Quintet, and as winsome as the landscape. Schubert said the countryside around Steyr, the town where he was staying, was beautiful beyond belief. So to play Schubert's first, his allegretto, followed by his piano sonata in A, here at Wigmore Hall, Elizabeth Leonskaya.